I am the god of hellfire, and I bring you fire. I'll send you to burn. Fire. I'll send you to learn. I'll see you burn.
You fought hard and you saved and earned.
Seen in the bright sculptures of Loess's halls. And every age renews its power from these works with every pathetic story possible to happen from hate or wayward love. Every sorrow and distress is carved here. Every affinity of parents, marriages, and friendships are here in all their various combinations, wrought with wondrous art. All that can happen to a human is that person's pilgrimage of 70 years. They know not why they love, nor wherefore they sicken and die, calling that holy love which is envy, revenge and cruelty which separated the stars from the mountains from man, and left man a little groveling root outside of himself. Negations are not contraries. Contraries mutually exist, but negations exist not. Exceptions and objections and unbeliefs exist not, nor shall they ever be organized forever and ever. If thou separate from me, thou art a negation, a mere reasoning and derogation from me, an objection. acting and cruel spite and malice and envy. But my emanation, alas, will become my contrary. O thou negation, I will continually compel thee to be invisible to any but whom I please, and when and where and how I please, and never, never shalt thou be organized, but as a distorted and reversed reflection in the darkness and in the non-entity, nor shall that which is above ever descend into thee, but thou shalt be a non-entity forever. And if any enter into thee, thou shalt be an unquenchable fire, and he shall be a never-dying worm, mutually tormented by those that thou tormented, a hell and despair forever and ever. And now, the hour has come round at last. This is the beginning, the first steps on the pathway through the Ask Dr. Hal show, live on radio. Yes, dear fiends, this is your irritating horror host, Dr. Howland Owl, here at my post in RadioValencia.fm, as they are pleased to call it. But this is a laboratory of the air, of pixels, of electrons scattering in bands, in rainbows, in arcs of inhuman blood. This is the program which only a recondite few are pleased to tune in, to use archaic terminology which we favor, choosing words from all sides of the salad bowl until this word salad is professionally and perfectly mixed and right and ripe for ingestion, not through the lips and with the tongue, but into the ears, whose small volutions shut out only melody and comprehend only discord and harmony. Awake, I say. The hour is late, and it is time to begin. To begin another venturing forth upon perilous seas in fairy lands forlorn. Forward and going outward, even as radio waves emanate at the speed of light from their point of origin. Here are calipers of fanatic measure breach the edges of the universe and spread their arms the entire length of the cosmos.
Is jelly beanish because each has different colors, though they were wearing a kind of tight leotard or something, and they're green, they're red, and blue. And the king is bald and has a small crown on his head.
Hey.
And a quizzical, kind of ready kilowatt kind of face. And
hi.
I'm sure everybody knows
the
ready kilowatt
him.
Reference.
Yes. We all remember him.
We all remember him. And Indeed, does Reddy Kilowatt still preside over the...
His jagged electrical arms and legs?
I don't know.
Well, he never died.
Some Reddy Kilowatts too large to have removed are
sure,
still
I'm going to let you look at this illustration here for a second.
All right.
Yeah.
You could
describe it to the listeners who are doubtless just pining away for more information about the...
Oh, interesting. Cartooning style for UI Pine.
Yeah.
For UI Balsam.
This is a great page.
I think so.
Great page in the morning.
The pint-sized king and the three jelly beans. Yes, he's pint-sized because he's a part teapot. Well,
he's part a pint-sized sawed-off monarch.
One pint.
A tin pot dictator.
The thing I remember about Jingle Jangle Tales is that a lot of inanimate objects are anthropomorphized. So there's
characters. As I ride so merrily along.
And part, in this case, nobility. A very pint-sized king. Are we having a little bit of zither? Or is this
zither among Zizians here.
Played by Robbie Basho.
Robbie Basho.
Why can't we hear a little bit of
great six and 12-string guitar.
The
Robbie Basho was killed by an ignoramus,
breezes,
a new ager, trying to give him a massage, which was fatal.
Zither goes whither
it will. It is no zither.
Zither goes. Zither,
whisk the idea of a zither from your mind.
Okay.
Keep that geranium out of your cranium.
Jingle,
yangle, yungle.
They were 10 cents only back in...
That's when I was a boy. Comic books were 10 cents. And when they went up to 12 cents...
Story.
Me and the other kiddos thought it was the end of the world. Movies cost a quarter. And now they wanted 50 cents. What was happening?
Under an umbrella. With an indeterminate green fringe.
Resolved with the messengers that the king sent out. What they brought him back, his desire was to expand his kingdom, which he felt was too small and containing him and keeping him at a small...
He bade his messengers ride forth east and west and south and north to summon his array.
Page as well, it shows a unicorn skipping rope.
No.
Under the moon.
I didn't know they could do that. I didn't know they could do that.
Yes,
no, I didn't know they could do that.
Moonstruck Unicorn and the Worn Out Shadow. That's a very nice title.
I guess.
Because when unicorns in uniforms wear out their shadows.
Unicorns do not herd, nor do they wear uniforms.
But
I gotta tell you.
Do wear uniforms.
No, they don't. They are not uniform. They are singularities.
I can't really read this.
Between nature and artifice, between imagination and the biological realm.
Well, they've reproduced these comic pages at a very low resolution. Somebody at Google should be fired for this.
But also the black.
Somebody's giggling at Google because of this.
Weren't interested in taking up the file space, so the comics are still being disrespected.
Yeah. I think so. I think there's a policy at Google that if
they don't know nothing.
Nobody.
They wouldn't recognize art if they fell over it in the dark.
And I don't think many people are reading Jingle Jingle Tales these days.
Well, not these days. People don't read the Elmer Fudd comics and Woody Woodpecker. It all has to be muscle men beating the bejesus out of each other.
Deprecating the Jingle Jangle Tales.
Yes, they can be defecating on Jingle Jangle Jungle, but there are some who will appreciate the artwork.
High resolution glory, as they should be.
And there was a wonderful comic strip which took place in a carnival, which was quite good.
Illustration here. It's like children are taking a bath with a... Might be an extraterrestrial.
I took a bath with some terrestrials. Recently, get up to.
Yeah, and they're bob. No, what they're doing is not taking a bath. It's Halloween, and they have gotten into the apple bobbing.
apple bobbing. Well, yeah. That's what I saw also.
Taking off her clown mask.
She was bobbing up and down. Yes.
Uh-huh. And she's
I know nothing about no clown mask.
Bobbing tub. She looks like she's very eagerly and almost obediently looking on as this self-indulgent boy has.
I don't think we're on the same page here.
While the little green or gray from Zeta Reticuli.
Enough.
You know.
No alien had anything to do with this.
Read about, or maybe know more about it, just reading about how fairy tales with the incidents of fairies taking
the changeling
and returning changelings to the doorstep.
I can tell you how that works.
This is,
in fact, I wrote a long poem about it, which I don't happen to have with me here.
Oh, like an earlier version of the abduction tales that we hear today.
Yes, but.
Yes,
quite similar.
End up with,
just the way the pixies and the goblins get you, and they pull you down into their little
by you, but
space under the hill. And time is not there as it is here, and it passes, and then everything changes in the outside world. In the matter of a single night, while the storm rages in its fury, the tempest and the thunder of the furious elements in conflict. The succubus, moving like a rag through the air above the rooftops, shapeless and invisible, save to those who know where and how to look, descends, floating down like a burning scrap. Only the succubus is not fiery, but cold, and it enters in through the open casement. And there, the restive youth lies, dreaming, having sexual thoughts, and the succubus folds around him. And soon, with a flash of lightning and a peal of thunder, the orgasm takes place into the cloth-like cerements of the folded body of the succubus. She lifts, and slowly rotating in the updraft, slips out into the furious storm, rising through the falling drops higher and higher. And then, in the electrical discharge of heaven, there is a strange transformation. The female attributes are absorbed, and the succubus becomes an incubus. And this being also descends. It descends, now superficially male, and enters into the chambers where a woman sleeps, her heart and head full of yearning and dreams. And again, during the storm, the orgasm occurs, and the former succubus, now an incubus, inserts the material gathered. And the human female is impregnated. And when the child is born, the supernal being is also there. And on the night of birth, steals the human child away and replaces it with the elf child, the changeling, which grows to full adulthood in the bosom of the family. Only occasionally guessing its otherness, and eventually, in secret protocols, makes common cause with the spiritual inhabitants of the invisible world.
How our ancestors were once hunted by dinosaurs in lost eons before we grew mannish. Alas, we evolved while the predators were stunted. It's long been said that only the sweet shall survive. Will our future be demolished by the past we contrive? So, you know,
this is an interesting question.
Well, what are they playing this through?
This is what I'm constantly contending with.
A prehistoric monster came from outer space, created by the Martians to destroy the human race. The Kempeitai is helpless, it's 20 stories tall. What can we do? Whom can we call? Call for Tobor, the eighth man. Tobor, the eighth man. Faster than a rocket, swifter than a jet. He's the mighty robot, he's the one to get. Call for Tobor, the eighth man. Quick, call Tobor, the mightiest robot of them all.
Or are there certain Heinlein books that I should be reading?
Yes. Well, he grew more conservative in his later years, but he had an ingenious mind.
He created one of the most amazing science fiction stories ever written.
Because his viewpoint is political.
Astonishing even today.
But he
thought of
all you zombies.
Stuff.
Look up that story. A lot of science fiction writers were inclined more toward the right than to the left. And I remember when, I think it was the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction.
Yes, it
during
was.
The Vietnam War.
Yes, it was.
Published all the science fiction authors.
Yes, they did.
And people in the science fiction world who were against the war.
Yes, they
in
were.
In alphabetical order. And then there were all the science fiction authors who were for the war.
Yes, they were.
So, naturally, Heinlein was for the war.
He was pro-war because he had not relaxed his mind.
On the other side,
from the post-war order of the world.
Starting alphabetically with Forrest J. Ackerman.
Yes, Ackerman, being an A, was the first to put his name down against the Vietnam War.
Forrest Ackerman, who not only created famous monsters of filmland and created Vampirella, but also was a literary agent representing A.E. Van Vogt and other authors, and wrote a letter to Professor Tolkien trying to secure the rights to make a movie based on The Lord of the Rings, which was never granted at that time during Tolkien's life. But as far as Ackerman is concerned, we are glad that he created the Monster magazine, still a staple of my reading, although I preferred its competitor, Castle of Frankenstein, which I hope to join. Since it is still publishing, I'm going to offer my art for it. I've just been so busy, I haven't been able to contact them yet, but I renewed my subscription. So let me see if I can tell the story that Heinlein tells so well of all you zombies. I may get it wrong. It's a complex story. But listen. A guy walks into a bar. Well, that's the way the story begins. Many stories begin that way. He knows the bartender. Well, everybody who attends a bar, is familiar with the bartender. However, these two have an unusual bond, which shall become understandable later. The guy who walks into the bar does not know this, but the bartender knows about him. The bartender knows everything about him. The bartender knows that this fellow sitting in the bar is sometimes called by acquaintances the unwed mother. Why would a man be called that? Well, it's because he writes stories for what were then called the women's magazines. And these magazines had female fiction. The magazine market today is nothing compared to when magazines entertained everybody. There were magazines for every niche of fact and fiction. There were things like railroad stories. Can you imagine a magazine like that? At any rate, the unwed mother wrote stories about women who were deserted by their lovers and had to bear children unwed. And this was lucrative, and he took a paycheck. But was that the only reason he wrote these things? No, he was compelled to do it, as we shall learn. So the bartender, polishing the glasses, asks him some questions, draws him out, and he begins to tell his story. And his story is, you're not going to believe this, but I used to be a woman. I had a sex change. Do you know what that is? Remember, this is like in the 1940s. Did you ever hear of Christine Jorgensen or others who changed their sex from female to male? Well, that's me. I was a woman. And in fact, I was an unwed mother. I never thought I would be a mother because the fact is I was ugly. I was not an appealing woman. But one day, in the park, I met a man, and though he was not what you'd call handsome, there was something incredibly compelling and mesmerizing about him, and we got along very well. And right there, that night, we became lovers, and in the park, we had sexual intercourse, and a child was conceived. And though I came back to the park for many nights, I never found this man. I never knew where he was, who he was, what his name was. But the child grew inside me, and it was difficult to conceal what was happening, and finally I went to the hospital and I delivered the baby. But it was not an easy birth. I had to have a cesarean section, and when the doctors made the incision, they discovered two sets of reproductive organs, a female set and a male set. And furthermore, the female set had been destroyed by the operation. The only thing left was to sew up and declare a male. And so in that one night, he, she said, I changed from a woman into a man. But at least I had the baby. No, I did not. Someone had come into the hospital while I was convalescing and stolen the child away. There wasn't anything left for me, but I had to make a living somewhere. And I was particularly qualified to write
the unwed mother stories for the magazines. And that's why I do, and that's why I'm sitting here telling you this now. And there's nothing that can be done about it. Oh, I wouldn't be so sure, says the bartender. I'm going to close a little early, but stay here. I want to show you something. Why don't you come around behind the bar? Now, you see this sort of silvery net on the floor? I would like you to stand on it next to me. And here we go. What's going on? We are traveling back in time. I am a member of the Time Lords, a group that has time machines and travels through time, monitoring human activities. Ah, here we are. We are in the park. The park that you know well. Why don't you go out and see if you can find a woman? You're going to find just the right one. And so, the man, formerly a woman, the unwed mother, goes out into the park and meets himself as a woman and is drawn to his earlier self and she to him. And wordlessly, they commingle and there is an orgasm. And then he realizes that he was the man who left himself when she was a woman. And staggering out of the park, he meets the bartender again. You know where you're going next. 9 months from now, the hospital. And he goes there. While his formerly female self is convalescing, he goes into the nursery and he picks up the baby and steals the baby from the hospital. And the baby is placed in an orphanage and grows up without mother or father. I hope I'm telling this story right. And eventually, that baby gets a job as a bartender. Becomes a member of the Time Lords, waits for the man known as the unwed mother to come in. They're all the same person. The bartender, the mother, the father, the baby. And when the bartender goes to sleep at night, before he turns out the light, he looks at the caesarean scar on his abdomen and he says, I know where I came from and I know where she came from, but all you zombies, where did you come from? That story was written by Robert Heinlein. So this is the type of imagination that it takes to be a successful science fiction writer.
I found a reference to the guerrilla police recently.
Not the guerrilla police, no.
And then comes the guerrilla police, and there they are on motorcycles.
Just who you need. The guerrilla police coming, right. Well, I hope we can do without that.
It was in this comic book. Like somebody made it up, but the fact that that happened doesn't mean it didn't exist somehow or somewhere.
Everything that is possible to be believed is an image of truth. William Blake.
Believed is an image of truth. William Blake.
William Blake.
Oh. Look at this. Here's another Jungle Stories cover for you.
Well, this time the babe is being menaced by an enormous lion. a male lion leaping with his claws extended, and she's tied up again. Yeah, tied up.
They're always tying up the cutie pies on these magazine covers.
He's coming from the top right corner, and he's even got one hand in the lion's mane at this point.
Usually the hero is bursting in with a great big chin and a drawn gun.
Yeah, Tarzan did meant to do that on a few occasions, but nobody else could. A lion is so incredibly strong, one just doesn't have the concept of what they can do.
They can kill you in an instant.
I suppose that is, they are pretty strong.
They're incredibly strong. Yeah. If you're standing by the lion cage and they reach through and they get you with their claw, they'll pull you through the bars of the cage, which are like, you know, 6 inches apart.
Oh, okay. Well, so what is stronger, a lion or a lion goddess?
A lion is all muscle. But, of course, the lioness is the one you really want to watch out for, because that's the one that does all the hunting and all the work, while the lion just lazes around. The males just lie around.
It seems to me like there's a leopardess here.
Oh, yes. Well, let's see that. She's got a leopard-type bikini on, like Sheena, before the word bikini was invented.
Sheena, the queen of the jungle, she wore those two-piece leopard skin outfits.
And often Tarzan would use a little bit of leopard skin to cover his male attributes, though Tarzan dressed very minimally, was uncomfortable with the clothes of the Tarmangani, which is the name his people had for white human beings. And yet Tarzan was just such a thing, a white human being, a white male, but he was raised by apes, as we know. But what apes? Not chimpanzees, not bonobos, not gorillas. He was raised by a type of ape no longer found in Africa. These were hominins. They were the descendants of prehistoric semi-humans. But they are apes, because we are also apes. If Tarzan had been raised by chimpanzees or gorillas, he would have grown up to be mentally a chimpanzee or a gorilla. But his people, the Mangani, had a language and were able to teach young John Clayton, later known as Tarzan of the Apes, all they knew. So he was pulled between two worlds, the world of the jungle, which he loved, and the world of civilization and society as an English lord, which he could only endure for a while. Now, if you read the Sheer Tarzan books, the second one is interesting because he goes to France, he is in a marital mix-up, he has a love affair, he fights a duel, there are two villainous Russians who give him a lot of trouble. Quite interesting to see how Tarzan got by in the world of the humans, but he was never so happy as when he was in the jungle being himself, a creature of the upper terraces. And don't be misled by silly movies where he swings on vines back and forth.
And now, I'll count very slowly.
You see, those vines are attached at the bottom. And many in Africa who have touched them have instantly pulled their hands away because they're covered with stinging insects. A vine might be attached at the top. It might be wound around the branches. But Lord Greystoke, that's Tarzan to you, would not have chosen that unless he had nothing else to hold on to. He brachiated, like his long-armed progenitors, from branch to branch through the thickly overgrown upper terraces of the jungle and of other jungles, for he was destined to visit exotic lands and places still not on the map, and perhaps never to be on the map.
I'll take another one of these drinks here. Well, this is the great new Kegor novel, The Silver Witch. And here, once again, the man is bound, there's a leopard, and there looks like there's a cat priestess here who's ready to sacrifice this man. Look at this cat priestess. She's very...
David Normal has these cat priestesses to go in his cat cult. I wonder how he contacts these women and what makes them wish to officiate.
Well, that's what cat priestesses are like, right?
Yeah, they are, yeah. Huh.
Well, that almost looks like Burroughs' Law of Opar, who was often in a position to sacrifice Tarzan on the altar of the flaming god, but somehow never got around to it. She liked him too much.
It's a pity Tarzan was so...
If they ever got together, probably not.
So faithful to his primary mates, Jane Clayton. So he never made it with La of Opar, who really wanted that.
The goddess or the muse, Calliope?
Or the music from the 19th century instrument.
Well, yes, indeed. The music I'm playing now is one played by mechanical instruments, clockwork.
So, very similar to Calliope.
Well, the Calliope is like a steam organ. Highly esteemed.
Automated also with early mechanical systems, and there were some that were for circuses.
Like
and,
piano rolls,
only their organ rolls. If you like the player piano, only they get up steam and it's blowing through the pipes when the roll.
The steam is a lusty blowing through the pipes.
Changes the position of the organ stops and everything.
Right. Okay. I'm still...
And may the bass of heaven's deep organ blow.
Do you not care for this music? I can...
No. It's fine with me. I just...
Always commenting and kvetching about the music.
It's the Calliope.
Well, let's hear the Calliope. If you want to hear the Calliope, we shall hear the Calliope.
Organ music playing.
The Beer Barrel Polka, played by the Mechanical Auto Calliope at Coney Island in 1956 in New York, or is it in New Jersey? And there I am, 5 years old, going on six, and how I wished to ride that roller coaster, but I wasn't tall enough. They had a height line. Oh, I came back in later years, and you couldn't get me off that roller coaster. Yes, the bartender in the Heinlein story was raised in the orphanage, but eventually, as he was destined, became a member of the time-traveling fraternity, with a particular interest in his own case. He was also the unwed mother, as well as the baby, which he had been, and the man who had impregnated himself. Well, our guest on this show was David Normal, the artist, who is delightfully delving into poetry and the old pulp science fiction magazines.
Deadline. Missed the 2 o'clock deadline. That will be a new headline, but I...
Headlines about deadlines.
Shut the... All Shuttlecock and Battledore.
And return to...
Return again.
Whatever it is, I return to.
Whittington, thrice Lord Mayor of London.
The best
way, of
course,
ignore your destiny.
And then I could close it properly and post it later on. But I wonder if I should do that.
Well, give it a thought.
It's 8 minutes after two, so...
On this previous show, but here...
I do.
And now, it's 10:41 p.m. on a Friday night.
They got lost, did they?
Mm-hmm.
Apparently they didn't have good guides. Or maybe they disregarded their guides.
Well, they did not have... They did not have Professor Challenger to guide them.
George Edward Challenger.
Well, Challenger could take them right to the base of the plateau, which contained Maple White Land.
Maple White Land,
that
where...
That thing in the movie where
historic creatures still roam.
A tree on a prominence and they knock it down. I think that's in... In the book, actually, also.
But it's not done by a brontosaurus, mm-hmm. like
so
in the movie.
That is, a brontosaurus doesn't push it off, but it is there.
I wouldn't put it past a bronto to do just like that.
An enemy of Roxton causes the tree to fall.
Everybody
forever in
thinks
glory
brontosauruses
glory.
Were peaceful and slow-moving, but in fact they were vicious
the
creatures.
Of...
They would go the extra mile to be malicious.
Who stands in there as a revenge.
Revenge.
Activity.
Sound, sound my loud war trumpets and alarm my 13 angels. Loud howls the eternal wolf. The eternal lion lashes his tail. America is darkened and my punishing demons, terrified, crouch, howling before their caverns deep, like skins dried in the wind. They cannot smite the wheat nor quench the fatness of the earth. They cannot smite with sorrows, nor subdue the plow and spade. They cannot wall the city, nor moat round the castle of princes. They cannot bring the stubbed oak to overgrow the hills, for terrible men stand on the shores. And in their robes I see children take shelter from the lightnings. There stands Washington and Payne and Warren with their foreheads reared toward the east. But clouds obscure my aged sight. A vision from afar. Sound, sound my loud war trumpets and alarm my 13 angels. Ah, vision from afar. Ah, rebel form that rent the ancient heavens. Eternal viper, self-renewed, rolling in clouds. I see thee in thick clouds and darkness on America's shore, writhing in pangs of abhorred birth, red flames, the crest rebellious, and eyes of death. The harlot womb, oft opened in vain, heaves in enormous circles. Now the times are returned upon thee, devourer of thy parent. Now thy unutterable torment renews. Sound, sound my loud war trumpets and alarm my 13 angels. Ah, terrible birth, a young one bursting. Where is the weeping mouth and where the mother's milk? Instead, those ever hissing jaws and parched lips drop with fresh gore. Now roll them in the clouds. Thy mother lays her length outstretched upon the shore beneath. Sound, sound my loud war trumpets, and alarm my 13 angels. Loud howls the eternal wolf. The eternal lion lashes his tail. Thus wept the angel voice, And as he wept, the terrible blasts of trumpets blew a loud alarm across the Atlantic deep. No trumpets answer, no reply of clarions or of fifes. Silent the colonies remain and refuse the loud alarm. On those vast, shady hills between America and Albion's shore, now barred out by the Atlantic Sea, called Atlantean Hills, because from their bright summits you may pass to the Golden World, an ancient palace, archetype of mighty emperies, rears its immortal pinnacles, built in the forest of God by Ariston, the king of beauty, for his stolen bride. Here, on their magic seats, the 13 angels sat perturbed, for clouds from the Atlantic hover o'er the solemn roof. Fiery the angels rose, and as they rose, deep thunder rolled around their shores, indignant, burning with the fires of Orc. And Boston's angel cried aloud as they flew through the dark night. He cried, "Why trembles honesty and like a murderer? Why seek he refuge from the frowns of his immortal station? Must the generous tremble and leave his joy to the idol, to the pestilence that mock him? Who commanded this? What god, what angel, to keep the generous from experience to the ungenerous or unrestrained performers of the energies of nature, till pity is become a trade and generosity a science that men get rich by? The sandy desert is given to the strong. What god is he writes laws of peace and clothes him in a tempest? What pitying angel lusts for tears and fans himself with sighs? What crawling villain preaches abstinence and wraps himself in fat of lambs? No more I follow, no more obedience pay." So cried he, rending off his robe and throwing down his scepter in sight of Albion's guardian. And all the 13 angels rent off their robes to the hungry wind, and threw their golden scepters down on the land of America. Indignant, they descended headlong from out their heavenly heights, descending swift as fires over the land. Naked and flaming are their lineaments seen in the deep gloom. By Washington and Payne and Warren they stood, and the flame folded, roaring fierce within the pitchy night before the demon red, who burnt towards America in black smoke, thunders, and loud winds rejoicing in its terror, breaking in smoky wreaths from the wild deep and gathering thick in flames as of a furnace on the land from north to south. What time the 13 governors that England sent convene in Bernard's house, the flames covered the land. They rouse, they cry, shaking their mental chains. They rush in fury to the sea to quench their anguish. At the feet of Washington, downfallen, they grovel on the sand and writhing lie, while all the British soldiers through the 13 states sent up a howl of anguish, threw their swords and muskets to the earth, and ran from their encampments and dark castles, seeking where to hide from the grim flames and from the visions of Orc in sight of Albion's angel, who, enraged, his secret clouds opened from north to south and burnt outstretched on wings of wrath covering the eastern sky, spreading his awful wings across the heavens. Beneath him rolled his numerous hosts. All Albion's angels camped darkened the Atlantic mountains, and their trumpets shook the valleys, armed with diseases of the earth to cast upon the abyss, their numbers 40 millions mustering in the eastern sky.
Dime Mystery Tales, and I have that. And but the odd thing is that a lot of the different digitizations that are included in these collections are not very good, or somehow problematic PDFs.
By the way, have you ever read any Doc Savage novels by Lester Dent?
Well, I know who Doc Savage is, but I don't think I've read the novels. Are they good?
Some people like them, like Ivan Stang, for example.
Or Philip Jose Farmer.
What do you think of the spider?
Is he a good guy or a bad guy?
I can't tell. I have, several issues of the Spider, and also several issues
Spider.
Of Captain Future.
Oh, yes, Captain
that
Future.
By Edmund Hamilton.
Right.
Yeah,
he wrote many Captain Future stories
covers, I think,
back in the past.
By Earl Bergey. Did a lot of
Bergey was famous for those drawing those babes on
in their underwear and spacesuits. Must have been transparent
spacesuits. Wearing short shorts and so on.
And exactly.
Brief halter tops as they float in space or are menaced by lewd monster aliens.
Without space, just without any kind of space suit.
Well, who knows what science would be able to perform. We will not necessarily have to wear those cumbersome suits if we can modify ourselves,
although
it seems
cosmic rays
arbitrary.
I'd like a cosmic rays,
a fluke of spit.
I don't seem to have enough capital here to spend.
I don't have the grand scheme.
I recently spent too much.
It was for the.
But I'm happy I did.
Kylo Ren character.
And I didn't like Kylo Ren one bit, but now I like him because I've seen him.
Yeah, now he's a cool
really
guy.
Good in other movies.
Why he has to kill Han Solo.
But I thought I liked him.
Yeah, sure.
He's the man who killed Don Quixote.
Don Quixote.
You ever
too,
seen White Noise?
I never heard of White Noise, besides,
I like
you know,
that. I think that's
White Noise.
Oh, that one and the Dead Don't Die.
Oh, yes,
no,
by Jim Jarmusch. That's his version of the zombie movie. And you know, Colson Whitehead, who wrote The Underground Railroad, also wrote a zombie novel, which is pretty damn good.
The Dead Don't Die, you ever see that one?
No, I never saw
it.
I like them movies about the Walking
about
Dead.
That? Didn't he also do a vampire show?
Yes, he did. He did.
I don't know about that.
Oh, he did.
Maybe.
He did. He did a vampire show, but it wasn't that successful.
He did a vampire movie? Jim Jarmusch?
I thought so, but I haven't seen all those movies either.
I like Nosferatu. You ever see that one?
The recent one?
The most recent one.
Yes, I did see it.
Yeah, I like that one.
It was extraordinarily well done. So well done that the subject matter escapes the mythopoetic and begins to be repulsive.
Yeah, but it's like, it's so...
But that helps the horror.
It's really engaging cinematically. Like,
yes.
Like, as it rolls along, it's like, it's really great. It like melds you with the movie, and it's like, it's really...
You're there in the early 19th century.
Yeah. Like, I felt more connected with that movie than a lot of movies I've seen.
Also, they were quite bold to have those two children killed by the vampire.
Oh, I don't remember that part.
Oh, well, these obnoxious brats who are in it, they're not very appealing, but unless they're children, and children usually don't get killed in a movie, they're the daughter, they're the daughters, yes, the two daughters of some blonde-haired character who is in the picture.
Remember the movie Mimic?
Yes, very well.
That movie had kids as victims.
It's true. They were killed by the giant bugs that live in the subways of New York.
Yeah. I like it when kids get whacked.
Yeah, it's rare that a kid would get whacked. What about Once Upon a Time in America? Doesn't Henry Fonda shoot a little kid in the early on in that movie?
Oh, Once Upon a Time in the West.
Oh, okay, yeah. Right, you're right. Once Upon a Time in the West, yes, of course.
Yeah, it's like, I think it's Charles Bronson is the kid who sees his dad get killed and, like, So the kid is traumatized and wants eventual revenge on Henry Fonda, which he gets in the final moments. But, like, it's like the death of his father is for the benefit.
Yes, well, that's the main sequence, but I thought that they, just to show how villainous Henry Fonda is, they had him shoot a kid, but now I'm suddenly not so sure about this.
I think it's like he kills the kid's dad, and he makes a point of, like, making sure the kid knows, and, like, that's like his sadism at work, you know? And it's so when Charles Bronson is gets Henry Fonda his comeuppance, he's steel-eyed and resolute, etc.
You know, one I've never seen is The Magnificent Seven, but I saw a clip from it that made me think, huh, well, this looks interesting. After all, it is based on Kurosawa's original movie.
Seven Samurai?
Yeah. Isn't it? I mean, I always heard it was.
Yeah, yeah. I thought there was a... Like Star Wars is with the Hidden Fortress. I mean, there's a through line there somewhere. But it's more pastiche-ier than that.